talking about the authority of the priests, like over the church or authority over the building. What happens if a priest comes to the church, is the appointed pastor, and he doesn't believe in Jesus and he's new and he's there? What do you do when you belong to that church? And what kind of things can come to you? Do you stay at the church? Do you leave the church when you know?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question. I don't have a simple answer for that. That's more of a social church organization question. All I can say is that remember that the sacraments, the efficaciousness of the sacraments is not tied to the state of the priest. So if the priest is doing Mass correctly, is doing confession correctly, those sacraments are valid. So that's the first thing to take comfort in. Your obedience to the church, the way the church is set out, and where you're at in life is the important thing. So if that's the only parish near you that is normal for you to be part of, kind of depends on how egregious the issues are. If the issues are egregious, you write a letter to the diocese and outline them, and outline what that priest has said to you or done that you have a problem with. That's a normal thing. If you feel that you can't stand it, then find another parish and go to that one and request to be registered at that other parish. But remember that if you feel in the meantime that there's no other option, the sacraments are still valid, as long as they're done properly. The matter and form of the sacraments is done. So I'm not a bishop, I'm not as privy and clued in to the way those types of problems are dealt with. But I do know dioceses get complaints all the time about priests.
What to the congregation that they prayed, brought what was being done, the sacrament was not being done properly, and they requested that but the bishop would not remove him at the time. And I don't know, I just wondered, it's like, getting cursed even going there. It was not
No. Okay. So the two pillars that support you in spiritual warfare of any kind is humility and obedience. If you're being obedient to the church and you're being humble before God, that's what protects you. So it doesn't matter if that priest is a full-blown satanic high priest and is doing horrible stuff at night while the church is locked. You're being obedient to Jesus' church as you experience his church that's been established. You're being obedient to the authority of your bishop that's placed his priest in the care of your soul. So the grace that comes from that obedience protects you and sustains you. For an exorcist, humility and obedience are the two things that keep them safe in their work. You don't overstep your bounds and do things you're not supposed to do. You do things within the apostolic authority delegated to you by that bishop, only when it's given. And you're humble. You get out of the way figuratively for God. It's not me, the big, powerful exorcist. Jesus is doing the exorcisms. I'm not saying to keep quiet. She's saying, should she fear for herself going to that parish? She already wrote to the congregation and her bishop. What we just covered was a question about what to do if your parish has problems in your opinion and the priest has problems in terms of validity of the way they're doing the sacraments, possibly New Age stuff, and whether you're in danger by going to that church. And in my opinion, the answer is if you're being obedient to the church, you're not in danger. Those people are in danger if that's true. I'm not saying that's true. I don't know who you're talking about. They're the ones that are being endangered by their behavior, not you, because you're being obedient to the church. Any other questions? Yes?
What is the role of the angels?
All right, so the question is, what is the role of the angels?
More specifically, our guardian angels.
Guardian angels. Okay. The preparatory step for every solemn exorcism, at least until the new rite is out, and I believe it's in the new one also, but we haven't seen the final version yet. I have the review version. So the exorcism rite was written in 1614. It's just been revised. as part of Vatican II. Final translation went to Rome for final approval just recently. Always since 1614 and probably before then, the Litany of the Saints was said as a preparatory thing for every exorcism. It's extremely likely that'll still be the case because it is very effective. Included in the Litany of the Saints is asking for Michael, Gabriel, and Raphael to pray for us, all the holy angels to pray for us. It doesn't say guardian angel, but it says all the angels and holy spirits. So presumably that refers to the people that have made it to heaven, the saints. And then the Litany of the Saints has, you know, Mary, the Father, the Holy Spirit, Jesus, well, not Jesus, but, and then tons of saints and a number of petitions. So that tells us that the angels and asking them to pray for us in what we're about to do is part of the preparation spiritually to bring protection to the conflict that's about to happen. So we know that through that prayer of the church, that the angels are part of what we're asking for their intervention. Specifically, one tip, and this is a tip for Father in a big sense, it's true for all of us, but very much so for priests. One thing that we've seen with some of the exorcists, and every exorcist develops their own certain little things that they may do. The rite is fixed, it's always the same. But an exorcist has different piety and different prayer in their own life and things like that. One thing that's very effective for a priest, if they're ever in a dangerous situation, or an exorcism gets violent and the demoniac gets their hands around their throat, or some throws them around or looks like it's gonna get the upper hand physically, you can quickly say, Saint Michael, defend the priesthood. And like that stops. He's ever present and has a particular function of defending priests.
And just yes. To confirm that, we actually do in a case where we'll do the St. Michael chaplet and the person that's possessed will put their hands like that and won't do anything. And the head superhuman strength and some other spots holding different languages and stuff. So St. Michael's huge as far as binding spirits, so that's true.
Yeah. And if you're ever overwhelmed, it's something you can say quickly. You know, it's a quick prayer. And it stops what's happening. So we know that St. Michael has a particular function in protecting the priests involved in this. Protection isn't often needed. It is sometimes needed. If God allows them to struggle. We know that they're in the Litany of the Saints. Of course, traditionally, we have guardian angels that protect us from the moment of our conception, right? I've never seen anybody particularly ask a guardian angel to intervene. It's usually Michael because he's associated with the warfare and associated with defeating Satan. So we know he was directly assigned to defeat Satan in the original fall. Do they help us? Certainly. One anecdotal story I can share in terms of angels is working on a case in one of the major cities on the East Coast for an exorcist. It was an oppression case. He was too busy. He was the only exorcist for a major East Coast city at the time. This was years ago. And we knew each other, and he asked me to pray with this person who was badly oppressed, literally the worst oppression case I've ever seen. And prayed with him solid for a year, 2 to 4 times a week for a few hours at a time. So a solid year of really praying for him. And there was one point, and I've only seen this once, I haven't often asked them to do anything, but he was sitting in an office chair that kind of has wheels on a wooden floor in his apartment in this city. And one of the oppressions that he felt was as if bags of cement were being put on him and his body was being weighed down. This would happen when he would lay in bed and his body would be crushed down into the bed and his spine was being damaged from the weight on him. And he was a nurse. He knew, you know, a lot about the body. That was his profession. He pretty much couldn't work at this point. This was just part of the oppression. I'm not gonna talk about the horrors of the case because you couldn't even talk about it in public. He was sitting in this chair and I was praying for him, wasn't near him. And he said, yeah, I can really feel them weighing down and crushing my feet right now. And I remember thinking like, I don't know. And I said, holy angels, would you pull that off his foot? And his leg went up and he got dragged across the room with his leg in the air like somebody's pulling a boot off you. But there was nobody there. His leg came up and he got, and he's like sliding across the floor. You're gonna have to edit that out of the audio. And got pulled across the floor by something that must have been, you know, 8 or 9 feet tall from the angle of his foot. So I know they're there, and I'm sure they're doing a lot to protect us. The main factor with the demons, at least in the exorcisms, is the apostolic authority. So I think they're serving an ancillary function of kind of facilitating. We did have one person, and I don't claim that this is true because I can't know for sure, but one particularly gifted person, and the whole charism thing is a whole huge topic. But this person seemed to have the ability to see with their physical eyes spirits of both good and bad types everywhere they went. Now, if you come across a person that has that gift, which is very rare, there are lots of people claim that they have that gift that like attention. The people that actually have that gift, in my experience, are not happy about it. It's a burden. They don't talk about it. And it's very hard on their life. Not that it's a bad thing. This person, at every tabernacle, every church they walked into, they saw Mary kneeling in prayer at the tabernacle. During the exorcism, they saw Michael standing there directing the other angels in what was happening. He wasn't laying hands on them, but he was directing. She could see the guardian angel of the priest and a second angel, only with priests but not with lay people, in front of them here, that she said she, when she watches Mass, they facilitate the sacraments, and that they, that second angel she sees with priests. I'm not saying this is valid, this is private revelation. I'm not saying it's true. So in that case, you know, we were doing a solemn exorcism and this person reported seeing, you know, various angels facilitating things that were happening in the room. So I think from my own experience they're there. I think from the church's prayers, we know that we're supposed to ask for their intervention. And I know from exorcist friends, and as Father just mentioned his example, that Michael has a particular role in protecting the priests, and he's very physical and very, very direct about doing that. Other questions? Yes?
Pam, you said about praying and prayer groups and elaborate again on that? I mean, we're not talking about people that are possessed or anything. We're talking about laying hands for when people ask to be prayed over at a prayer group.
Okay, so, yeah, the whole laying on of hands while praying is always a touchy subject. And I think it's a touchy subject because a lot of people want to do that because it feels good and it feels powerful and special. And the person's suffering, and if I'm the one that goes and lays hands on them and they're healed, I feel good. I feel special and I feel validated by God and I get attention and it feels good. So there's a natural human part of that that's really hard to escape. What typically happens is there'll be a prayer group where people are praying for each other. In the charismatic schools and universities, there'll be these student groups and everybody's piling hands on somebody and praying and rebuking and in every kind of way and directly commanding and all of that. If they stumble across a truly possessed person in the midst of that, because you don't know who's coming to these prayer meetings. And I've talked with demoniacs or severely oppressed people in major cities who in their desperation for help in earlier years had gone to these meetings. They would see a flyer and be like, oh, maybe I can get help there. You know, this endless nightmare could be over, so they'll go. And so there's a possessed person in the room. Nobody else knows that. They're just there looking for help. And these are unregulated meetings, so you don't know who's coming in there. One thing that one told me that was very telling, and generally it is true, is that because they were possessed or badly oppressed even, they can feel when demons are with other people. So they can be in a room and you and look at you and be like, well, yeah, I know you've got one too, because I can feel it. It resonates with the one that's in them or with them. And this person would go to these prayer meetings and they said, I would walk in there and I could see and feel 3 or 4 of the people in here were demonized also. They were just there to infect other people. They weren't there for help. And I believe that because I've dealt with enough witches and Satanists in debriefing after their exorcisms that have told us that they do stuff like that. And I know, because I've dealt with church cases where churches are afflicted, the physical buildings are afflicted, that they've been infiltrated by satanic covens of people pretending to be members of the church to do damage to that congregation. So we know that they do these things. So of course they're going to come to a prayer meeting where you're doing spiritual warfare. So my point is that the laying on of hands is really a priestly function with prayer. Your hands should be consecrated if you're doing that. Because if you touch and pray and you come across a demoniac, you have challenged that spirit that's with them, and by touching, you have basically engaged in a direct struggle with it. And now here you are, a layperson, you don't have apostolic authority from the bishop, your hands aren't consecrated, you don't have priestly authority, and you've just now poked a fallen angel in the eye with a stick. And you're touching it. That's why it can be so dangerous. Most of the time you're not stumbling across a demoniac when you're doing those things. And so nothing happens. And maybe even some good things happen, sure. But you're kind of rolling the dice. And I would think, and hopefully this will be clear and I'll be able to get some citations from our canon lawyers on this, but I think in the end the church probably has made this more clear. And certainly the letter from Cardinal Ratzinger in 84 made it very clear that lay people are not to speak to demons ever, under no circumstances. So if you're going in that prayer meeting and saying, in the name of Jesus, get out of her, you're breaking a rule that Cardinal Ratzinger promulgated in 84. And that letter's on EWTN's website.
Now, is that Excellentissime Domine?
I don't know.
Okay.
But it's on their website. It's easy.
Is that one in your book?
Yes, it's reproduced in the book. Oh. Yeah. Yes.
Some years back, I was leading the renewal in Rochester, and we had a prayer group of 20 people. The priest had a service and anointed us to pray for healing, which is what we went out and did, and after the masses and things, we did see miracles. I'm not aware of anybody getting possessed. Now, Did that make it consecrated? Was that all right? Is that something to do or still not doing?
Okay, so again, you come back to humility and obedience. So if a priest tells me to do something, unless his instruction is disordered, and I know it's disordered, at which point I would have to cite the canon or the catechism and explain why I feel that I can't morally comply. In this case, you would say, like, well, it seems reasonable enough, and Father's asking me to do it, and I've never seen anything against this, then you're being obedient, and there's protection in that. I'm saying that from a practical standpoint, and I suspect in the long run we'll be able to document it, that it's not wise to randomly pray over strangers and lay hands on them. In that case, the priest had told you to do it, so there's a lot of protection comes with that. But if you're just going to go out there and be the hero, and you stumble across a demon, the demon's like, well, by what authority are you addressing me, basically? And I'm telling you that I've seen possession cases that came out of that. I'm not saying that's going to happen every time. But if you stumble across a demoniac and lay hands on and challenge that demon without any authority backing you up, then when it pushes back against your prayer, whoosh, that's what the people told me. They feel it rush into them, and they went from zero to possessed. And they've been possessed ever since. Yes, immediately.
Holy oils as lay people.
Oh, that's a tough one. Of course, chrism, the oils, okay, she asked about using holy oil for, well, there's different oils. So there might be, the question is, what about using oils for lay people? If it was olive oil that was blessed, which is a traditional oil that's used for healing, my understanding is technically that's okay. Certainly not chrism or the oil of the catechumens, right? That's got the Holy Spirit in it directly. It is used for very specific things. We're not even, shouldn't even be handling it. But anecdotally, what I've been told, and I think this is wise, is if you're going out in the world and working on cases, a lay, layperson probably shouldn't go around anointing people with oil because it can cause confusion in the public. Oh, well, Sally came over and anointed me. Isn't that the same as when Father anointed you? I don't understand.
And I think that's how they interpret it sometimes.
Right. And even if you try to explain it in the midst of people being scared and upset and wanting this to be over, they may not really hear that part. It's like, yeah, yeah, okay, just, you know, get rid of the problem. And then it's over and they're talking to their friend and talking about how you anointed them. So, again, it comes back to the pride issue. You know, I want to feel special and powerful and I'm doing this neat thing with the oil and it's like a priestly thing. I'm making a cross on somebody's forehead. It's exciting in a way. And you have to guard against that because, again, it gets back to magic versus religion, right? So if I say, oh, I need to use the oil because then the magic thing happens and this will be over, like, now I'm a magician. I got to go get the magic oil and put it on in the right way and then suddenly it'll go. Versus submitting to God and saying, Jesus, I know it's at your command and at your will whenever this is over in whatever way you end it, and I accept that. And praying for that person, why is that any less effective? It's less dramatic, it's less about me. But to give an example, and this isn't about me, in some of the worst exorcisms I've been at, there was one, we were in a church, which is the best place to do them, within 20 or 30 feet of the tabernacle, but not close enough that they can get at it. Usually they wouldn't be able to approach it. All kinds of noise and loudness and just dragging on and on at this session. It was an ongoing exorcism. And having great difficulty, as we often do, getting the name out of the thing. Usually they don't give their name until their rites are removed. They'll just say, no, I'm more powerful than you. I'm not giving you the name. Or other colorful language that we won't repeat. But usually they just say, no, I'm stronger than you. I'm not giving you my name. But once their rites are removed, they give their name and then they're cast out in very quick time. Well, we were really stuck this day. And Father was tired. We were really hoping to make some progress that day, but that's our limitation over human hopes, right? And nothing was working. And I remember I just said, Lord, we're not sure what to do. And I said this silently. I said, will you make your creature tell Father its name? And like 2 seconds later, it leaned back and screamed and howled and then shrieked its name out. You know, and that's after like hours of this dramatic, formal thing, because Jesus is the one doing it. And so in that moment of giving him the honor, it's not us. This is your creature. You know, you're in charge. He answered. And I've seen him answer simple prayers like that, simple requests in the midst of these things that have highlighted for me the fact that it's not about us. And the more it's about me and my special things, it becomes I'm the magician. And it's not about Jesus. So that's kind of the roundabout way of saying, like, I think technically with the olive oil, technically you'd be okay. I don't know. I mean, Father, what would you think?
I think I agree with what you're saying. If it causes confusion, you'd want to watch it. But if the person understands, then I think it would be okay.
Yeah.
They understand the difference.
And if it's not feeding your pride, too, you got to kind of check yourself. Like if I'm feeling really special because I get to do the oil anointings, now it's feeding the pride and you have to be careful. Because in spiritual warfare, the enemy doesn't just push back in the current situation you're in. They sit back and say, they have a little committee meeting and say, let's make a plan for this person. And they have long-term, you know, attacks. And so they can slowly pump up your pride here and there over years to get you to the point where you're vulnerable. Yes?
Yes, Adam, in your book regarding medical and mental illness, it says some of the common misunderstandings, medical illness and mental illness are sleep disorders. Sleep disorders account for most complaints of negative spiritual activity. This also covers the time speaking on behalf of Father DeJule and myself. We were both invited separately to give talks on an occasion. He was also asked to lay hands and pray over people. And at a separate time, I'd done the same thing, another day, which he had given me permission to do so. Both of us almost simultaneously began to experience some sleep disorders as a result. There were three women that we both prayed over. And one of the people that happened to be with me, in fact, I myself happened to, if you want to call it, discern that there was something wrong with these three women that came up to be prayed over.
Meaning they didn't really want help?
Yeah, I sensed the spirit of witchcraft.
Yeah.
In all three of them.
Yeah, they were witches.
Now, would that leave Father as well as myself open to?
Not that much. Typically, okay, so in general, it's important to understand that, you know, when Paul says the fiery darts of the enemy, you know, against somebody who's being obedient to God just fall to the ground, right? They don't even hit us. That's very true. Really is. When we're being obedient as best we can and doing what it seems clear that Christ is asking us to do, and the best way to know that is if your bishop asks you to do it, you don't worry about those things. Now, that being said, can there be small backlash, annoying things, parlor tricks? Yes. It is common for an exorcist to get visited by a demon before the exorcism even starts. Before they get the phone call for that case, they may have a minor manifestation at home. It's a calling card. You're about to hear about me. I'm the one you're going to be dealing with. But it's minimal. It's a parlor trick. They're not harmed. And after a while, you get used to these things. It's almost like a heads up that God allows, like, hey, you know, get ready, make sure you're straightened out because you're going to get a call soon. Could you have gotten a little bit of backlash from praying over them if they were actively praying against you? Only as much as Jesus allows. So again, could that have been a heads up as part of the discernment process? Like, wow, we prayed for these people and suddenly, you know, we're having these minor issues and I had this feeling they didn't want help. So usually there's a reason that's being allowed. For myself, I imagine by now, you know, innumerable witches and Satanists have done all kinds of things to try to kill me or cause problems. I don't believe that anything can happen unless Jesus allows it. I've spoken to the public many times. I've had full-blown Satanists in the audience come up to me afterwards. They'll stand about 6 or 8 feet away. One said, I thought I was serving something powerful, but those things behind you terrify me, and I'm never going to speak to you again, and walked away. And other people have seen angels around. I think angels only show themselves when God wishes it, so that person gets the hint. Not to scare them, but to be like, you're not touching this person. It's not a drama thing for God. He doesn't need to show his power. But for these people that are there to actively try to curse you or hurt you, they may say, like, you know, and just look at them for a moment, and that's enough. That's the way it typically goes down. The place that can be tricky is hell does want to take revenge on us, of course. Are they allowed to? Generally, no, because you're doing what your God wants you to be doing. The place that can be touchy is with people that are close to us that are vulnerable. So if you have somebody close to you that isn't in a good spiritual state and so is more vulnerable, they may hurt them because they can't get at you. So when I first started all this, the first exorcist I became good friends with, a Benedictine exorcist, and we're now best friends for life. We worked together for a long time. Great monk. The first time I ever spoke to him, I was handed a cell phone in a car. He didn't even say hi. Somewhat surly, said, do you have a wife? No. Do you have children? No. Do you have any pets? No. Well, okay, I guess you can come to the rectory. We'll talk. And that was the end of the conversation. He got much nicer later. But he was being very protective. My father was thrown down the stairs of his house when he was home alone in the middle of the night. My father, he's dead now. He was almost 6'4", not fat, just a huge man. Physically big, and he was an iron worker, a big guy. He woke up standing at the top of his steps. He didn't know how he got there. And the next thing he knew, he was in the air. He was thrown so hard he didn't touch any of the steps. He he landed at the landing and broke his neck. Now, he recovered from that over 2 years, and he was spiritually not in a good place with God, and through that experience had such a conversion that prepared him for his death 10 years later, such that he was very close to Jesus when his time came. And so God, even in that moment, allowed it and spared him dying in that bad state, and then brought great conversion out of it. So this soul, I think, was, not that he was damned, but it was certainly greatly helped by the devil in spite of the devil. The devil serves in spite of himself. So there are dangers for us that are appointed to be in these circumstances. It's not that it's like, oh, I don't need to worry about anything. You try to be vigilant, try to stay away from mortal sin as best you can, stay close to the sacraments, but most of all, obedience, humility. If I'm being obedient to my bishop, the other bishops that may ask me to serve in some way, to the exorcists, I don't worry. The demons trash talk in the exorcisms, they threaten, they bluster. Bishop sent me. I'm not going to worry about it. But this is serious too. And if somebody's close to you that is vulnerable, you need to protect them by catechizing them and encouraging them, because sometimes they'll take revenge on them. Yes?
Why is it that the church has delayed becoming active again in the absence of training for priests in the seminaries throughout the country?
So the question is, why is the church, why has it not been active and not trained priests in this in recent generations, and why now? Well, my understanding from many priest friends and bishop friends is that the West became very intellectual and very secular, even in the church. And so there was a time starting in the 60s when all of this was dismissed as mental illness. And if somebody comes to you talking about this stuff, send them to the psychiatrist, and that was literally what they were told in seminary. And so they're not meaning to do any harm, they're just saying that that's what they told us to do, and I don't know anything more about it. Now that's changing. The young priests coming up right now seem to be very much on fire, very spiritual, very hungry for this information, naturally, not in like an exciting drama kind of way, but in a good way in context in their priesthood. That's at least what I'm seeing. The bishops are saying that the reason it's coming back now is because they're seeing real cases. They're saying, when I went through seminary, we didn't talk about this. And as my time as a bishop, I've never seen this, but all of a sudden in the last 5 years, I've seen this 18 times or whatever. Now, when the USCCB had its special session on exorcism in 2011, I believe it was. Boy, time is flying. I think it was 2011. They had a special session on exorcism at their yearly meeting in Baltimore. This was in the New York Times. It was in the news. There was reporters there asking, like, why are you guys talking about exorcism? Bishop Papraki, who had organized this, was there and gave a statement to the New York Times and basically said, we're seeing real cases and we're looking for a way to respond. That's the answer. Yes?
Could you comment a little bit on Lozano's unbound method of deliverance, non-confrontational, where the sufferer can renounce the spirits? And...
Yeah, so the question is about Neil Lozano's work, Unbound, which is a very popular book in many deliverance circles. Neil and his son were at a training I gave for the Philadelphia exorcism team a few months ago. And he's good friends with a good friend of mine who's one of the exorcists for the Philadelphia Archdiocese. So we got to spend a day together talking about this stuff. Because I've heard about his, I have his book, I've never used it really. I've heard lots about it. I've heard different ideas that people have about how it's supposed to be used. So I got to talk to Neil, and our conclusion was what I thought it would be. His stuff is really meant for self-help. It's meant for oppression and inner healing. Never intended it for full-blown demoniacs or exorcism. He understands that the full-blown end of things is for solemn exorcism, and the church has a remedy for that. That's how we deal with that. He told me that his model, his intended model was, you bring the person in once, you explain all this to them, you give them the book, and they go off and do it themselves. So that's from talking with Neil personally you know, and we got along well. We're going to get together when the occasion arises again. He's a very nice guy, and his son's very nice. I think Neil's kind of, in a sense, retiring, you know, slowing down, and I think his son is taking over, which they seem to work very closely together. Yes?
Catholic Church, there are some priests that are sort of stand out, what they call healing ministries.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go for prayer, you feel a power coming out of them. There's also lay people, even, I think, they're allowed to go into the church and lay hands and have this ministry. What do you say about this? Because it's very charismatic, falling down in the spirit, visions with that. You know, I'm sensing a little caution here with things you're saying. So, what do you think?
Try to be explicit about the caution in what I was saying. So the question is about some of the charismatic stuff, like the lay people laying on hands at healing sessions, perceived energy from priests that are doing healings, being slain in the spirit, visions, all of this. I'm very cautious. I come from a community of exorcists. I'm not an exorcist, I'm a lay person, but all my friends are exorcists. We work closely together. Exorcists tend to be conservative, stick to the fixed ritual, because you're dealing with an active opponent that's wily, and you want to be on rails and keep things fixed, and that's safer and more stable and predictable. Exorcists tend to be boring, predictable, stable kind of approach, not this, I'm feeling this and I need to go over here now. I'm not picking on that, but that's got no place in an exorcism. Because demons, if somebody has these sensitivities, can play that like a violin. That's where they live in that realm. They're fallen angels. They still have their faculties that they had when they were holy angels. These are wily opponents that have been manipulating mankind for all of mankind's history. If they can tempt you, that means they can affect your mind, right? Isn't temptation prompting in the mind or the body? So we know they have access to us. And if you're psychically sensitive, whatever that means, which some people say there can be natural gifts versus ministerial charisms that could be perceived as being psychic, whatever. If that thing can tempt you and it can mess with your mind a little bit, and you're really into being sensitive and having visions and whatnot, and you go in a room with a bunch of demonized people and you're trying to be sensitive to stuff, don't you think they're going to play on that? Seems to me common sense. These are vicious criminals. And if you're seeking to have input, you're inviting input. So that's why I'm really cautious about these types of environments.
We have a prayer group in Buffalo that's run by lay people, and they lay hands on the sick.
I'm sure they do.
And they are slain in the spirit, some people.
Yeah.
Now, is that dangerous?
In my opinion, potentially, just like going out to work with the public is potentially dangerous. You could go in the community and work with drug addicts, and one day somebody's flipping out on drugs and they hurt you. It's potentially dangerous. I'm not saying it's always dangerous. I'm saying my position is prudent based on experience. I've seen cases come out of that. I've seen pride come out of that.
Is it dangerous because a person doing the laying on of hands has an egotistical bent? Is that the danger, or is it
right. Okay, so think about obedience. If Father, who is he's the pastor here, so he has authority here, and I'm in his parish with permission from my diocese, and Father says, I'd like you to lay hands on this person and pray. If I do that in obedience to a priest with valid authority over me while I'm functioning here in this diocese with permission from my diocese, probably nothing bad is going to happen. Was it disordered? Maybe it's not egregious. I'm not sure the church is super clear. If he were to say, I want you to talk to that demon, well, then I'd have to say, no, there's a letter that I can cite. I can't obey you. It's a disordered command. Okay? But if I go in here and I come here and I'm visiting and I'm just talking to a group of people and there's no authority telling me to do anything and I'm here in Buffalo and I come over and lay hands on you and start talking to the spirits that might be afflicting you, well, now I've done something because I want it and my pride, and I'm going to exert my will, and I'm going to be the special guy, and I'm going to be the guy that came in from out of town and laid hands on people and did this dramatic thing. All of that to me smacks of pride and me, which is magic, versus if I submit to Father and then I say, okay, well, if this is Jesus wanting something to happen and the church is asking me to do it and it's not disordered, that's different. Do you see how they're different?
If I lay hands on someone who's just had a heart attack and I just say a prayer, I'm not invoking demons. I'm not,
right. I'm not really talking.
We do a lot of touching.
Okay. I'm not talking about healing prayer. I'm talking about demonic problems. Okay. This talk is on infestation, oppression, and possession. And what the church does in those areas. Straight up healing. Now, that being said, if you go to a stranger and they end up being a demoniac and you're doing that, maybe you'll run into a problem. I mean, but there's some risk in life with everything. I still think it's a priestly thing to touch with prayer. I think that's a priestly function. I can't prove it to you right now.
But you know, they're very short in supply.
I know. I know. But again, it also comes back to this. Why can't you pray and ask Jesus to heal the person?
Yes, you can.
Why do you need you to touch the person for them to get healed? Isn't it Jesus healing the person?
I'm thinking more of the human thing. People really want to be touched.
I know. I'm just a cautious person because of the stuff I deal with and the stuff I've seen. So my perspective is cautious.
Boy, it sure is confusing.
I'm trying to be clear, but...
I mean, it's confusing because of our motivation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That only makes it even more confusing.
But again, it comes back to humility and obedience. So maybe ask the pastor of that church, Father, do you want us to be laying hands on while we go to these prayer meetings? Now you're putting yourself under obedience.
And you know what? It doesn't hurt to have a group of people who just pray.
Sure, of course, of course.
We have one or two people who just pray.
Well, you should be praying for each other.
Yeah.
I mean, any exorcism team, you need to be praying for each other. You also need to be friends with religious communities. If there's some cloistered nuns in your city, you need to make friends with Mother. And when you're in a session, Mother needs to know so that some nuns are in chapel.
Whoever wants to do that, or whoever is called to do that, to be prayed over by a priest. So that the prayers are effective for that group?
Well, as long as the priest is directing you. Again, humility and obedience versus selfishness and magic. Versus pride and magic.
I've been in a couple of sessions where Father was doing exorcism and we were praying. And a couple of times, the spirits in the person began to mock him and attack him. But you said, if lay people never speak to demons, the priest can't speak to the demons?
Yes. All right. So the question is, one, clarity that lay people shouldn't speak to demons. Yeah, there's no question about that. The 1984 letter from Cardinal Ratzinger clarified that for the world. Lay people are not to address demons, only priests. Secondly, does the priest speak to the demon? Yes, but in limited ways. So there's two ways to look at that. In the 1614 exorcism rite, which is in the Roman ritual, it's a fixed rite. It has a praenotandra. Praenotandra is introductory instructions. The praenotandra has, you know, many parts. They're brief statements of wisdom that the church has learned over centuries. Look out for this, don't do this, make sure you do that. In the rite itself, if you read the text, the only questions that the priest reads from the book are, and I'm not quoting because I don't know the exact quote, is, who are you? Meaning, what's your name? How did you get in this person? By what right are you here? So who are you? How did you get here? And when are you leaving? That's it. Okay?
There's three questions.
Well, let me finish. So in the rite, essentially, those are the only three questions the priest commands the demon to tell him that. And please make note, ask is not the right word. You never ask a demon anything. If you ask a demon something, you're going to get a raspberry back. You command it to tell you some information. So, who are you? By what right are you here? And when are you leaving? Now, the second part of when are you leaving is, when are you leaving? What's a sign of the departure? So the specific language is, what is the date and time of your departure? And what will be the sign? because there's sometimes a dramatic supernatural sign when the final demon leaves. Not always. But in the Pranatantra, the introductory instructions, there is a note on addressing the demon by the priest, and it says the priest may interrogate the demon about topics relevant to the case and to explore by what rights the demon is there. So the Pranatantra opens up the possibility that the priest may need to ask follow-up questions, but only related to the rites by which the demon got there. Not what was your name in heaven before you fell, and how many demons are there, and what does Satan like, you know, for dessert. None of these curiosity questions are valid. And by the way, if you ask a curiosity question, anything unrelated to the case, the demon, like a lawyer, will literally say, that is not relevant, I don't have to answer you. I'm serious. I've seen them do that. Now, they may throw in some colorful language, but they often will literally just say it flatly. That's not relevant, I don't have to answer you. Because when they answer, it is compelled by God. And God only compels them when it's relevant to what you're doing, which is trying to save that soul from the entanglement that it's in. You deviate from that topic, you're into selfish territory. And there's no longer really protection or authority anymore. Because you've stepped out of what the church prescribes. Now the nice thing is the demon tips its own hand often and lets you know that you've stepped out of that. Sometimes they might play along with you and encourage you to step further out. So you have to be careful.
Will the exorcists try to find out the numbers of demons that may be present? And I'm assuming that the reason he would ask the name of the demon is so that will help him determine a strategy.
Well, okay. Okay, so the question is about the names and why they're relevant, why we might want to know the name. There's a few reasons why the name is important. The most important reason from experience is that when you pray against a demon by name, the prayer is focused like a laser and hits the demon harder. That seems to be the case. It's hard to know exactly what's going on, but once you get the name, the prayers are like a hammer when they're set against it by name. That's been what I've seen. But is that because you're praying against by name, or is that because you've removed its rights and so the prayers are hitting harder? Because usually they give up their name after their rights have been removed. You'll say to the demon, by what right are you here? Like, well, you know, she was engaging in premarital sex at this time and I was able to attach to her then. And then you come out of the session, she confesses that, the rights removed, you go back into the session, okay. Do you have any other rights? No, that was it.
Do they always tell the truth?
They tell the truth.
The demon, does he always tell the truth?
Ma'am, I'm trying to answer you. He only tells the truth when the priest commands him to let me finish.
Ah.
No, the rest is important.
Ah, that's a good point.
No. Only tells the truth when a priest commands him to give information that's relevant to the case. If a priest asks for something irrelevant, he either lies or says no. If a priest without the bishop's permission says something, the demon says, I don't have to listen to you, literally, and walks away.
So even then he's telling the truth.
He is telling the truth. He'll tell the truth when it's his advantage. Now, if a priest has authority and the priest says, who are you? The demon will either say, I'm Bob, or he'll say, I'm stronger than you right now, I'm not going to tell you, and he'll just take the pain. So he'll tell the truth and say, like, and what that means is you haven't undone my rights yet, so my hold on this person is stronger than yours right now, so I'm not telling you my name. You undo the rights, and then he says, I'm Bob. I don't have any more rights. And then the prayers hit him harder, and he leaves. Now, let me finish exploring names. If you would, I'm not trying to cut you off, but I want to finish unrolling the thought. So the name is important, and the church tells us to seek the name, but you don't always get the name. In many cases, you don't get the name, and they still come out permanently. What we do typically see, lower-level demons, because it's a pyramid organization like a military, and in every person or every case, there's a group. It's never just one. There's a manager who's in charge of the case, a spirit who's in charge of the case, who's like middle tier. There's 9 ranks of angels, 9 ranks of demons. Middle management, somewhere in the middle, is in charge of the case. Foot soldiers, low-level demons, there are lots of them. You'll cast those out left and right in the beginning. The low-level ones are crude, animalistic, aggressive, trash-talking, and they love to talk. And they curse a lot. And they're violent. But they're not very smart. You get up to middle management, and then you get into a little more polished. They say less, they're less violent, but they're more dangerous. They're smarter. When you deal with the low-level ones, they will often give you a name that is a function. I'm death, I'm suicide, I'm incest, I'm jealousy. Now, are they lying? Sometimes a priest will say, no, give me the name that God gave you when you were an angel, when you were created. Almost always, they will say, that is my name, because that's their function. Now, when they were created, their function's an inverse of that. So an angel created to guard chastity, when it fell, now it becomes a demon of lust. They have the same faculty, but the faculty is reversed. So the low-level demon will often tell you a name that is a function, but it is its name. I've also seen demons, and they seem to be sincere, because under duress with authority, they still say, I don't know. I've seen low-level demons say, I can't remember my name. Satan tortured me for so long, I can't remember who I am. And they've experienced no duress from the prayers or the repeated commands. So they seem to be sincere. When a demon's lying, it's in pain, and the prayers hammer it, and it's distressed, and it eventually gives you the truth. So, middle management, you get into proper names. So you'll get a name that you haven't seen in the Bible, but it's a proper name. It's not just a function anymore. Then, generally after that, you'll get to the tier right under Satan, which is only a few. Those you'll get into biblical names, ones that you recognize from the Bible. Beelzebul, Baal. Belial is the most common that I've seen in exorcisms. He seems to be the one that is in charge of most exorcisms I've come across. I know priests have dealt with Asmodeus. He's associated with male homosexuality. Leviathan's associated with female homosexuality. Baal, I'm not sure what he's associated with. Moloch is associated with abortion and child killing. There's many, many. But they're all in the Bible, and those would all be your one notch below Satan, upper management. They don't always come. If hell cares enough about the case to get beyond your middle management, which is a name you won't recognize, but it's a proper name, if hell cares enough, one of those guys will come, and you're like, oh, okay, now we're dealing with somebody we recognize from the Bible. And they generally speak even less or even more intelligent, and in a sense are more dangerous. Because it's not a physical threat, it's more of a spiritual and manipulative, and their parlor tricks are better. And then in rare cases, I've only seen it twice, once maybe, twice definitely, where Satan cared enough to come himself. So once in a while, he'll come and fight for the case after that one is cast out. The other way that Satan can show up is some priests, and this is a totally valid way to approach it, instead of slogging through all those sessions, some priests just say, let's just skip to the end. I want Satan here right now. And they'll just call the boss and say, all right, why do you have these demons here? Give me all the rites. And they just try to nip it in the bud and take the whole system out at once. That doesn't always work. Why? Because that's not always the best way for that person to be healed. Jesus knows best. And if somebody's been possessed for 20 years, and their whole personality and their whole life is built with the presence of all these other forces and factors and voices and emotions and parts of themselves, and it's all ripped out at once, it would be like shock therapy. People often will say, I don't know who I am, I don't know how to be, I'm confused, I'm not sure about my feelings, because they've had these things their entire life. And so Jesus will remove it layer by layer, and the person adjusts and grows over the months, and so they can kind of grow out of the experience. Not everybody can handle having it all ripped out at once. So that's giving you more information around names. So yeah, names are often important. When you get to the higher rank ones, they want to tell you their name.
Wouldn't you say it kind of also helps the person to know what they got to work on and pray against?
Yeah, yeah. So the other aspect of names that can be good is the pastoral side of it. So if you have a demon and he says, I'm suicide. And it's like, okay, well, Jesus has forced this demon to be more present today. And it's a demon of suicide. Well, Jesus made that demon be present. That gives us a clue pastorally where he's leading us. And so outside of the session, you work with the person on issues of suicide or self-harm and see if there's work that needs to be done there. Almost always there is in whatever was exposed. The other nice thing that can happen regarding specific demons is during the Litany of the Saints, you'll hit a certain saint and they'll go ballistic. Certain name and blam, they hit the roof. That's a clue from God that there's a demon present that needs to be dealt with. So sometimes you'll get a clue about the nature of a demon that you're going to deal with that day from the litany, and you think about that saint and what was their virtue. Their virtue will be the opposite of that demon. Secondly, that also tells you to ask that particular saint to help you in dealing with that demon later when you're in the middle of the exorcism. And if you happen to have a relic of that saint, that's the relic you want to bring into the session. The other thing some exorcists do, I'll tell you that some exorcists do this. I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's a little creative and probably shouldn't be done until you've been doing this a long time and you're comfortable. Some exorcists will command a demon to tell them which saint that demon fears or hates the most and force the demon to say what saint opposes them that they fear. It's the opposite of the vice that demon foments. That can be useful. It's a little bit off the reservation, but it's been effective. There are certain things in this work where it's not all science, some of it's art, and different priests have different ways of approaching it. So I would say in the first 5 years, stick to the ritual strictly. Don't deviate to other questions, but this particular priest had access to a lot of relics, and for them and their priesthood and their ministry, that was kind of useful because then they could go get the relic that the demon admitted to, and that advanced the case.
And maybe kind of going back when you're speaking of deprecatory prayer and imprecatory prayer, you know, relating to the five keys that Von Baum, you know, the fourth key, which is the key of authority, you know, it almost seems like it's a prayer, an imprecatory prayer, where it says in the name of Jesus Christ, I break the power of every spirit.
Okay, so there's a big difference in the church, or there's more latitude in the church in prayer said for myself in self-defense. That's what I've been told. I'm not a canon lawyer, but my understanding is if I'm personally attacked and feeling cornered and threatened by some spirit, in that circumstance, in self-defense, I have wider latitude of what I can say. So I could say in the name of Jesus, get away from me. Because it's in self-defense, I have wider latitude. That's what I've been told. I'm not an expert on that topic.
Well, based on the fact that we have been using this at times, not all the time, but let's say, for instance, the team leader, I'm the team leader, we'll take a documentation of what that person is saying to us. We come to the conclusion of what spirits we may be dealing with, and then as the team leader, I may be the one to take authority over that. Is that actually doing the right thing, or is that thing going into an area of danger?
My advice would be have the person take authority over themselves. Because in that circumstance, so again, let's say this is Father's parish and I'm in his parish. Father has authority over me spiritually. If he's praying with me to a certain extent, he has canonical, spiritually legal authority to do things, to say prayers, to command. I have authority over myself. Because this is the body and the self that God gave me, right? Just like you have authority over your baby and you can baptize that baby because you were granted that authority by God, and God honors that. Likewise for myself, I have authority over my own body. So for that, I would encourage the person to take authority over themselves, which they already have, but to acknowledge it and state it, and then exercise that authority. but for you to exercise authority over them that you don't really have. If you were their priest, then you do have some authority over them, but in this context, you really don't canonically, I don't think. Does that make sense before we move on? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
About obedience, us that are from Rochester, we don't have an exorcist in our diocese. So what is the remedy for people in our area for exorcism?
Well, you're under your bishop's authority, period.
Well, he wants to appoint one, but he didn't know who to appoint yet.
So okay. Okay. First off, just to be clear, you probably know this. An exorcist priest normally only treats possessed people. They don't deal with oppression. They don't deal with house cases. The rare, truly possessed person, which in like a major city, there might be one, maybe four at the extreme at any one time in the country, in a major city. There might be one, maybe two, maximum four I've ever heard of. Unless they're busing them in from other places, which there are places that help a lot of people that don't have exorcists. So, if you had one, they would only be there for those. They wouldn't be there for the oppression cases and all the other work, the bulk of the work. You know, 8 or 9 out of 10 calls are going to be house cases or oppression. It's rare you're going to get the possession. If you come across a full-blown real possession case that meets the church's requirements, and they've gone through their evaluations medically, psychiatrically, then you just write a letter to the vicar general is probably the best person, not the bishop directly. The vicar general usually is the one that quarterbacks this stuff. And say, you know, hey, here it is, here's the case. Can you seek out another diocese to assist this person? Many times bishops have requested to other bishops that have an exorcist, hey, can your guy come over here and do this? Or can I send my person to you? As long as both bishops agree, it's canonically fine. And that happens on a regular basis. So that's what I would do.
Calls from Toronto, we're getting calls from Syracuse Diocese. You're sending us all these people and it's like, wait a minute. Do you have somebody in your diocese that can take care of this?
They probably don't.
It's crazy.
They probably don't.
We have several deacons in our ministry. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about
deacons.
I
think the role of the deacons, I mean, when it comes to full-blown exorcism, there's no question. It's canonically defined. Only a priest can do it, okay? So there's no question there. You can't do exorcisms, solemn exorcisms. Can a deacon do a house exorcism? Probably not. And why I say probably is because the new exorcism rite hasn't come out yet. It should be out within months. It'll have its own praenotandra with clarification. The old minor exorcism for a house did say priest with permission from their ordinary. Okay? So that leaves you with blessings and catechesis. Now, that being said, the new rite is coming out, and instead of just having the solemn exorcism for a person and the minor exorcism for homes or places, it has solemn exorcism for a person, homes and places, and the third section is prayers for the laity to be said by themselves, basically in self-defense. So that's a really great addition. The praenotandras of those sections hopefully will give more latitude to the deacons. We'll see. Certainly the house blessings and catechesis can carry a lot of weight. Now, I'm also aware of some dioceses where a deacon has been put in charge of the exorcism program by the bishop. They don't do exorcisms, but they're in charge of the program. They've been charged with setting it up, coordinate it, report back to me, because that deacon's known well to that bishop. He trusts him, and he's like, look, Dale, I want you to go do this, because I need somebody that I know well. And I know of deacons that are doing heavy house cases, and their bishop has told them, go do the house exorcism. Okay. Bishop told me to go do it. It's fine. Because there's not absolute clarity on the house exorcism. Some printings of the old Roman ritual say that. Some printings don't have that. It's just one little red three-line thing at the top that says priest with permission from the ordinary. But then you can find other versions that don't. So if the bishop tells him to do it and he's been fine, we'll have much greater clarity in a few months. And then you'll know what your role is. I've seen deacons provide prayer support during exorcisms, no problem. be present at the exorcism, be an additional person, but not praying the exorcism prayers, doing the responses, maybe just praying quietly, you know, in the background kind of thing.
Would that be similar to the prayer of minor exorcism and baptism?
Yeah, so the minor exorcism and the baptism, now you can do baptisms, right?
Yes.
Okay, well then, and see, let's be clear on this. Most of what we're talking about today when we say exorcism is a solemn exorcism. And when we say solemn exorcism, we're referring to the Roman ritual rite of solemn exorcism for a possessed person. When you say solemn exorcism, it's a public action of the church. It has very strict restrictions on it, and it's that fixed rite. The church has many exorcisms that aren't solemn, that are included in many of its prayers and rites, okay? They don't all require a priest. The solemn exorcism clearly says, and then in canon says, you know, there's like lots of locks and constraints on it. This is only a priest. But the baptismal exorcism, that's fine for you.
What would a private solemn exorcism?
Well, it couldn't be solemn if it's private. Because by solemn, part of the connotation of that word is a public action of the church. Now, technically, you could say those same prayers privately. But if you use those same prayers privately with a possessed person, you're really, really doing something risky. Because those prayers are going to add... Okay, so let me unpack this really quick. There's essentially three parts of any exorcism. There's agitation, which is basically getting it riled up, right? The gospel readings, the litany, the rosary, whatever, gets it riled up so it manifests. There's agitation, there's interrogation. So get here, who are you, get out. So there's agitation, interrogation, and adjuration. That's really all an exorcism is. And you'll see as you go through the rite, it switches between those things. Let's beat it up for a while, now ask it questions, now tell it to leave. Okay, it didn't leave, beat it up some more, ask it some more questions, tell it to leave. If you do those prayers privately, it's gonna be enough to get it angry enough to fully show itself. And because you don't have apostolic authority lent to you because you're in a private situation, you don't have the ability to say, sit down in the chair and put your hands in your lap. It's just going to jump on you. And you're probably going to experience a supernatural strength. And the injunction at the beginning, you're not allowed to harm me, these people, or any of their possessions or their loved ones, it's not binding. So that's why, like, doing those privately with a possessed person would be wildly dangerous. You could, if you did them privately for a home where the family's in good order, everything's fine, and it was a pre-existing problem they moved into, it would probably be fine. You're a priest, they're your people, that house is in your parish, you have authority there. They don't have rights or attachments to any of the people, it would probably just depart, even if you said it privately, quietly, very discreetly. And then if that didn't work, then maybe petition to get permission so you have apostolic weight behind it. But honestly, in most cases, unless the family's disordered, even a private minor exorcism for a home works. But not for lay people. The priest who has authority over that family and that home, not just anybody. There has to be some authority.
With this home problem, my daughter bought a home. And, you know, we did blessings and blessed salt and... you know, and pray. I didn't have any feelings of anything, but you're saying, you know, always trust your feelings. But in the kitchen, always in the kitchen, weird things are happening. And I'm beginning to think there's got to be the spirit in the kitchen because it's something I've never experienced in my life. But you're saying I can't pray and bless the kitchen and have that removed? Is that correct? That I have to pray?
Well, hold on. What I just said was, to do a minor exorcism of a home privately, it should be done by a priest who is the pastor and has authority over that home. not a layperson. A layperson shouldn't be doing the minor exorcism. Why? Because a letter from Cardinal Ratzinger from 1984 said lay people cannot talk to demons, and a minor exorcism involves talking to demons. Begone Satan is in there. Okay? So no, you can't do it. You can't talk to demons. You can't say begone Satan.
How come Protestants do this all the time? Haven't they done what you know? Don't they know how dangerous it is? Why do they do it?
Well, okay. So what generally happens, the Protestant approach, they had to come up with a way to approach this problem without the sacraments or without most of them. They had some of them, but not all of them. The Roman Catholic approach is the vehicles of grace are the sacraments and other things support those in a person's life. The Protestant methods are essentially citing scripture, okay? Because most Protestant work stands on sola scriptura, me and the word. That works up to a point. When they come across a full-blown case, like a possessed person, it just makes it angry. And historically, I'm not picking on anybody, but historically they come to the Catholics. Also, hold on. Also, many other religions come to the Catholics when they get real full-blown cases, because the Jews are the exception. Jews call them Dybbuk, and there are rabbi exorcists. They don't tend to talk to outsiders about it. They don't ask for help. The Muslims have rabbi imams. They call them jinn. In the parts of the world where Muslims and Christians live side by side well, which there are many, they're not all troublesome, when they get a real case, they come to the Christians or the Catholics, depending on the part of the world you're in. So the perspective that I'm explaining to you is as the church is picking this ministry back up in the last 10 years, we're, as a community of exorcists and of people, we're trying to do our best to figure out all this and how it works. We're looking at what the church has written down over the centuries. We're looking at what we've seen for the last 10 years in the actual exorcisms, and it's meshing. And so what I'm sharing with you today is the outcome of that 10 years. So do many people have all this information? No. That's why we're working hard to disseminate it. That's why that pastoral manual is free to any priest to go through the world, because it's a start. I would, you know, it's just a start. I'm not a professional writer, and it'll develop more, but that's what we're trying to do, is disseminate so that more people can get help and, you know, Jesus's will can be, because he must want this to happen, or it wouldn't be happening.
To continue talking about exorcism outside of the church, on the internet, YouTube, you could go and listen to Bob Larson. I listened carefully to him and read some of his works. I have some respect for Larson, although he has more of an entertainment approach, and I think part of that is that a priest is supported by his diocese his diocese, whereas someone like Larson does not necessarily have a support group. So mm-hmm. Yes, he charges to not only perform the exorcism, but if you're going to watch it, you pay a fee for that. Now, what's extraordinary about Bob Larson for me is that given what you've said about the dangers of the layperson being involved in exorcism, he has three absolutely beautiful daughters, 18, 19, and 20, who are exorcists and perform these exorcisms on television and for audiences. How crazy that is. How dangerous that is.
Okay.
How real is it?
So the question is about Bob Larson, and who is a Protestant minister who calls himself... Does he call himself the real exorcist?
Yes, he does.
I think he calls himself the real exorcist. He's big on TV. He charges a lot of money. He asks for people to sign over their pensions to him at the end of his presentations in Vegas. That's been recorded by hidden cameras. He seems to have started okay back in the day when he was just a radio guy. He seemed sincere to me back then. The big issue I have with his exorcisms is if you watch them, almost always, they're exactly 11 minutes long, which just happens to fit in a YouTube video. I have never seen an exorcism that's that predictable.
Really?
Most, generally our sessions are weekly for 2 to 3.5 hours, maybe more if the demon won't leave for the day. I've never seen one 11 minutes. So the other thing is they're very theatrical. I don't see any of the signs that the church looks for. I don't see them speaking in other languages. I don't see them interrogated in languages the person doesn't know. There's not supernatural strength. They strain and whatnot, but just two people are standing there holding them. I've seen a person pinned to the floor with 5 men on them lifting them off the floor. I don't see supernatural strength there. I don't see him testing for detecting the holy. So, and I don't see hidden knowledge. And I see 11-minute exorcisms that seem to be for TV. Now, those people seem sincere, but are they hysterical in the classical sense of hysteria? I think maybe. Yes, Father?
On full-blown diabolical possession cases that you dealt with, how often do you do the rite you're saying for a particular case?
So the question from Father is, how often do we typically do the rite in a real possession case? I always recommend once a week.
Okay.
Because the person needs time, one, to physically recover. It's extremely strenuous on their body. They're exhausted afterwards. Secondly, they need time to reflect and settle and then go to confession, repent. They're going to come to you 4 days later and say, Father, you know, I've remembered some other things about earlier in life I hadn't remembered before. You know, can we talk about that? You need to give them some time to kind of settle. And once a week is also somewhat reasonable for the priest. The side of it that we often miss in the early years of doing this, when somebody's new, is to manage the rest of your responsibilities. It's really easy to overextend yourself with this work. These people are very demanding, they're very needy, they're very self-centered in the sense that they have no problem calling you at 3 in the morning, you know, from the driveway saying, you know, you need to get over here. And that's okay. But it's really demanding. And one of the tricks of the devil is to overwhelm you. And one of the things that the guys in Rome say, like Father Bamante, who's the president of the International Association of Exorcists right now, who's a wonderful priest, wonderful exorcist.
Yeah, I saw him in Rome, actually. Julie and I witnessed exorcism cases with him.
Yeah, yeah. So he's awesome, right?
Yeah.
One of the things he says is there are no emergencies. And that's really true. If God is in charge of everything, there are no emergencies. So when there seems to be an emergency, if it's truly an emergency, call 911. Don't be afraid to call the police and stabilize the situation if it's a true emergency. But if the person's just upset and wanting you to drop everything, you know, and not attend to your other duties to deal with this 24/7, you can't do that.
What do we do if we have a priest? Health isn't always really good. He's a little bit older, and he's just got tons of cases. Is there any way? What do we do in that situation? There's no way he can possibly do it.
You need
once
to,
a week.
Right. You need
what
to.
What do we do in those kinds of
situations? Well, you need to ask the bishop to assign somebody to assist if there's that many cases. That's number one. Ask the bishop to assign somebody else to assist.
Well, I'm assisting, but I don't have, if he's not there.
Well, then you need faculties.
Okay.
Ask the bishop for faculties. Ask for a decree giving you faculties to do this when he's not there. You're in a good situation. Ideally, you'd have 5 to 10 years of a young guy learning before the old guy is done, instead of reinventing the wheel when he drops or retires. So you're in a great situation. But if you've been to a number of sessions, and if you're trained up enough and feel okay, go to the bishop and say, let me get started because Father's not going to be doing this forever. And don't do it alone for a while. Be there with him, but you do it, you know, for as many months as you can.
Okay.
That's what I would do. The other thing is ask Jesus for help with it. Make it part of your prayer life. Lord, if you're calling me into this, okay. But Father's overwhelmed, there's a lot of cases here, and would you please move the bishop, you know, to help us? Because Jesus is very aware, and he's also very aware of any priest he pulls into this. You'll see indications that Jesus really wants you involved in this in a priest, and then there's other priests who are like, no, I'm inherently terrified, I don't even want to go in the room. And then other priests, he'll take away the fear. It's not that you're proud or courageous, you're just like, I don't feel any fear. You just know what you need to do and you just do it. That's a sign of the charism, in my opinion, just my personal opinion. The two things I see in priests that are called to this is a lack of fear and a particular efficacy in their prayers. When they're praying, even when Father's not praying, they're praying, the demon's just gnashing its teeth and hates it. So those are the two things I look for.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up regarding there's no such thing as an emergency, because this past Monday, we got a call at the office, and this woman was talking about her son being possessed. And she says, who's going to be able to help us? I said, well, right now, Father DeGiulio is ill. I says, if you're patient, I says, we can talk to him. Well, we need it now.
Right.
I said, there's no way we can do it. Well, let this be on your conscience then. I said, what would be on your conscience? I said, it's leading me to the truth, to tell you the truth, that Father DeGiulio is ill, he can't do it. If you want to hang up on me. But you don't work and wait on me for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's inappropriate. Yeah, that's inappropriate, obviously. So, yeah, some people are very demanding, insulting. You'll encounter the sentiment is often, you know about this stuff, so you're somehow responsible. You need to fix this right away. That's the feeling that you get from a lot of people, is they say, oh, you're the person that deals with this. You're at the root of this somehow. You need to fix it. Exorcism should be done on the church's schedule. Don't let the devil dictate when you do exorcisms. It's very important that the priest and the diocese be in charge of these things and when they happen, and don't allow people to bully you into jumping. You must attend the other responsibilities that you have, and again, there's no emergencies. We need to set the terms for when people are seen. There are many people floating around the country. They drift from diocese to diocese, demanding exorcisms because they are convinced that they have a demonic problem, because they have an intractable medical or mental problem, usually mental, but they're functional enough to travel around. I'm not making fun of them, it's just the case. And they will not listen to any amount of counsel or reason about it. They are fixated on that idea, which is one of the reasons it's so dangerous to pray over somebody prematurely. So that person may say, you got to do this right away. And if you let them bully you into doing things too much, then Father did an exorcism. He's possessed. They wouldn't have done an exorcism if he wasn't possessed. And now the idea is cemented. And then some of these people, that they've been migrating the country for years. And you'll hear through the grapevine, oh, they're up here now. And they're harassing this bishop now. And now they're over here. And they get known. And there's no amount of talking to them that works. They just won't listen, because some people want an exterior thing to blame for their problems, and they're convinced that somebody can take this thing away, as opposed to facing, you know, doing what they need to do as best they can. Some problems just don't go away, but the church isn't, you know, we try to diagnose well and offer good counsel, and the premature praying can be a big mistake, and that's another reason to not let those situations bully you.
So as lay people, and those who are here and not here part of the team, we've got this many people that we're seeing in teams and praying with them, describing our role, it seems like we really can't pray oppression out. But you're saying we'd have to pray it out themselves, right? What do you see us doing exactly? More specifically, I hear what you're saying, but also maybe a little more clarity.
Okay. So, it's very important. The Protestant approach to dealing with oppression is to pray and command. Right? The Catholic approach that's built around the sacraments is renunciation, the sacramental life, prayer and blessings. So the Protestant approach, because they don't have the sacraments, dive in and start commanding, laying on hands, that approach. We are Catholic. Our main vehicle of grace is the sacraments. The Mass and confession are the two most powerful tools an oppressed person has. Catechesis helps them get to confession and engage in it in a healthy way, and then get to Mass. If you ignore those sacraments and just dive into praying over a person, you're ignoring our Catholic identity and our Catholic faith. These are the sacraments instituted by Christ to bring healing, to break the chains of sin, and to bring the grace through the Eucharist to a person. We do a big disservice to our faith when we dismiss all that and say, I want to go lay hands on this person in a dramatic session. Okay? That's why I'm trying to say, up to possession, the church's approach is renunciation, the other sacraments, prayer and blessings. Why do I say the other sacraments? Sometimes baptism is involved. Some people aren't baptized, and you bring them through RCIA, or you get their marriage normalized, can also be an impediment to some cases being resolved. So sometimes other sacraments are involved, but usually it's Mass and confession. So please hear me. I'm not just saying you can't do your thing, but I'm saying the thing that you're doing is basically the Protestant approach, and the Catholic approach is engaging in the Catholic life. Does it make sense, Father?
So we should lead them even more into this.
Yes. Your work with them as a lay person, just in my opinion, would be more fruitful to spend more time in catechesis and preparing them to move into the sacraments as opposed to praying over them. You can include praying for them, in my opinion, and if you feel that, no, that's not good enough, I need to lay hands on them, then you need to explore why you need to be special. I'm not picking on you, but some people have a need to be special and like do a priestly thing. I'm not picking on you. But some people are really into that, like it's exciting for them, and that's okay, that's human. So what I'm saying is pray for them, catechize them to help them get to the sacraments in a healthy way. That's what's going to free them. Until they undo those rites and use the sacrament of confession to completely remove those sins and those rites, your praying over them is just going to rattle that spirit around. Do you see the difference? It's a good question. The question is, are there any good books to read?
We have a bibliography that Father has. It was presented to him at the conference in New York, and it's extensive.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about, that's great that there's a list that you have, but you want to be sure that those books are Catholic. And the reason I say that is because Mundelein has a strong reputation of mixing deliverance and exorcism together, and a lot of Protestant laity have been involved in Mundelein. Yes, big time. To the point where many priests won't go anymore because they leave more confused than before they came. But it's getting better. And the Pope Leo Institute, which has grown out of it, which is for priests by priests, from what I'm hearing, it's much more orthodox and squared away. So there's a history of some confusion. So just be careful if you take a reading list from Mundelein to vet it before you say these books are all solid. Because I just don't know who made that list. I'm not picking on them, I'm just giving you a caution based on what priests tell me that have gone there. Okay?
This question has been with me all afternoon, and I'm just wondering, given that these demons are so busy tormenting us, what is their existence? Are they in hell or out of hell?
Yeah. You know, you pick up snippets of the picture here and there. What seems to be, we only know part of the picture. It's not really important either, but what seems to be is that when they're assigned to a person, to work on a person, or to ride a family line down through the generations and take out as many as they can, or to possess somebody, or to rattle around in a house, they're doing that job because they've been assigned to it by Satan. They're terrified of being punished if they fail. Their only motivation is fear. So they're going to keep doing that job as long as they can. Sometimes when they're about to be cast out, they will reference going back with Satan, and they will say, I'm weighing the pain you're giving me now versus the pain he's going to give me for failing. And he's going to hurt me worse than this hurts, so I'm going to stay for now. But there comes a point where Jesus says, go. And then that's it. But sometimes they seem to leave, kind of just, they leave. And then other times they say, I can't leave. I desperately want to leave, but I can't. So there's sometimes that Jesus says it's not over yet, even though the demon is being horribly tortured and wants to go. But they do say sometimes, there was one case where Father said, are you so-and-so from last week? And he said, no, I'm so-and-so. He was cast out last week and he's still being tortured for his failure. I've also seen a demon say, as I've referenced earlier, and I don't know if this is true, this is demon talk, so big grain of salt, but it insisted, I can't remember my name, Satan tortured me for so long I've forgotten. And even under duress and repeated commands, he wouldn't give his name. And he didn't seem to show any duress in lying. I'm not saying that's true, but these were indications that when they're with Satan, they're tortured horribly, and they would much prefer to be roaming around with people where they're not being tortured, where they're assigned to some job. The lake of fire isn't used until the final judgment. The Bible's pretty clear they're cast down to earth to roam here till the end. There's not a hell, so to speak. There's the Jewish ideas of Gehenna and Sheol, right? So Gehenna was a trash dump on the edge of Jerusalem, I believe. And Sheol, I think, was basically kind of like the Greek idea of the underworld. It wasn't Greek. I mean, it was Jewish, but it was kind of the same idea. It was a shadowy place that you went when you died. They didn't really have a model of getting to heaven or any other option. It was just kind of an underworld. So there's really not a hell, so to speak. The hell currently seems to be being with the demons. So the damned souls that are around, like we've met Judas Iscariot. We had Judas in one case. A number of exorcists have dealt with Judas. And by the way, the issue with Judas is because he's a human soul and not a demon, he's not under the same authority, and so he's not bound to the priest's commands.
Again, please.
Because Judas is a human, he's not under the same bound injunction as the demons are. Christ gave authority over demons to the 12 apostles, not over damned souls. So sometimes Judas or other damned souls that are heavy hitters downstairs, so to speak, will be sent just for the purpose of physically hurting us or doing things that a demon couldn't get away with.
So what does the priest do in that case?
Well, Judas, and I know this sounds funny, but I mean it seriously, he's really a jerk. In the case that he was sent, he said, I was sent here to scar you so that you'll look at that scar for the rest of your life and know that hell marked you. That's what he said to me. He was in a woman and he was scratching and cutting up people with nails, with the nails of the hand. He didn't hurt me. Go God. In that case, he left by asking Jesus to make him depart. Because it didn't work the same way as a demon, because he was a human soul. He has free will, and he's not under the same authority, so it was kind of a weird situation. But many people have dealt with him. I would just ask Jesus, Lord, you've allowed him to be present, okay, but would you please command him to depart, or reveal what we need to do for him to move on, and ask Jesus to do it. By the way...
But they wouldn't do the right...
Well, you wouldn't come across a person only possessed by Judas.
Okay.
They would be possessed by a colony of demons, and Judas may show up in the course of the exorcisms.
Okay.
When you encounter damned souls, they're kind of dragged along with the demon in the case. They don't seem to operate on their own.
I think this is important for all of us, because just remind, we deal mostly like in deliverance, mostly people who have problems. There was a book I read, I think it was Listen How Important This Means About Confession. She's a Protestant, she's a wonderful Episcopalian. And she's talking to us, a major psychiatrist, about all these problems with people. He says, I've experienced that 90% of my clients are Protestant, only 10% Catholic. She says, what do you think that is? He says, well, from my investigations, they have the sacrament of confession. And it's a big healing to people. Confession. Then he went on to talk to some priests and said, less and less people are going to confession. More and more people need doctors now. And we just had a client, a young kid, and we told him he wants to be in our ministry. So, okay, you can't meet your girlfriend. You got to go back to church. You need to go to confession first. with the master communion. No excuses, because he wants to be a nurse as some nuns are talking to him. So do that, give me a call. I call him up, I say, how you doing? He says, I got rid of my girlfriend, no living with her no more. Can I come and see you and Father? Father Julie came to see you. We talked, he said, yes. I said, well, I'll go to confession, which I'll have to do. That's a big part of all our healings, our commitment to do it. Now, like you said, I take authority over you. If a person really wants to take authority...
Well, ultimately, yeah. Ultimately, it's them that has to do it, ultimately.
In fact, you can go further. You could say an exorcism doesn't work if that person is living in sin. The evil one sticks around where he's fed.
Well, until the person repents of that sin to remove those rites, you could do exorcisms for 20 years. And
in a case like they argue with me about it. Oh, I can't get married. Living with some, I can't get married. Why not? I don't wanna. She says the devil was laughing all the time the exorcism was going on, and nobody understood what she meant. But then I probed.
Mm-hmm.
She was living with someone. She wasn't married to him. She wasn't going to give it up.
Yes.
The Protestant exorcism for the Catholic rite is not used. Valid? Successful?
Well, do you mean valid canonically?
Some success, or they wouldn't be operating.
Well, like I tried to say before, the Protestant approach generally works up to a point. If they come across a full-blown real possession, it doesn't work. It just makes it angry. Yes?
When you pray with people, if they want to be free and follow your instructions, is it generally then that they all do get free? I mean, is there a percentage you pray for it's still mysterious? Or?
Yeah, of course. One, we're not God. None of us are. We don't know what's going on in its totality. We know what's in front of us. We help the person to move forward spiritually from where they're at right now. Sometimes they don't reveal to us till 2 years later that there's this huge thing they never told us about. It's just like in psychotherapy. I'm a shrink. The rule of thumb in psychotherapy is your client that you spend that intimate time with every week doesn't even start to tell you the truth about who they are for at least a year. Yes, there are cases that drag on and we don't know why, but there's factors there that we're not aware of. We tend to only be shown what's right in front of us. So the Holy Spirit does inspire and help and guide this work, but generally just for the next step in front of you. And that's safer, because if you saw too many steps in front of you, you start steering the boat in a different way. And Jesus wants you to say, what's in front of you, right? What am I showing you right now? Do this right now. Just that next part. And again, it comes back to humility and obedience. I don't see the big picture because I don't need to. I need to be obedient to the boss and do what he's put in front of me. And if he prompts me in that moment, and I'm sure that it's God, and there's, you know, other confirmations and ways that that's useful, like, wow, you really need to get to confession, it, you know, just keeps weighing on me that maybe there's some other sin here you haven't told us about, or, you know, whatever, without blaming the person or beating them up. You know what I mean, though. That's just my experience, that with this work, he shows you just the next step in front of you.
One quick question, too. As I was reading something in this Mundelein book, but it talks about that you shouldn't actually pray the rosary in between doing the rite. But when I saw Francesco Bamante, he did that. They would pray the rosary in between doing the rite.
Is that?
That was just a big book. From Mundelein.
Oh, okay.
But is that true? Should you
pray the rosary?
Doing the rite, should they not do any other prayers in between?
You mean while it's going on, or in between when they're
doing
taking
the rite,
a break?
Like in between stopping and doing the deck of the rosary with people.
I think any prayer is great.
Okay.
The rosary is a particularly good idea because Mary is so intimately involved in the end of almost all cases. So even people that are not Christian and don't even really understand who Mary is, they describe the same beautiful woman comes in the room when it's over and tells them it's over.
Okay.
That's not every case, but that's like 8 out of 10 cases. Mary is the one who comes and tells the person, done. So Jesus sends her. Father René Laurentin, he's a French priest. He's probably the greatest Mariologist alive. He's ancient now. really old. I mean, he's probably 100 or more. He was one of the founding members of the International Association of Exorcists.
Yeah.
And he's obviously really into Mary. And I was talking with him at one of the meetings, and I asked him if there was any prayers outside of the exorcism rite that had been helpful in cases that were intractable, that dragged on forever and you couldn't find a way to end it. And he smiled and he said, yeah, I've seen the Magnificat.
Wow.
Has liberated more people. Not then in exorcism, but most of those intractable cases, the Magnificat is what has helped them. So, yeah, I would, and also anecdotally, when there's been people in the other room praying rosaries while the exorcism's going on, demons will complain about it. They'll say, tell that pig in the other room to stop fingering those beads or whatever. They'll never say the rosary. They'll call us pigs and, you know, but obviously it's upsetting them. Yeah. I don't mean to shock you by saying that. That's mild, right? I'm not shocking your conscience, am I? Okay. I'm not trying to be dramatic. I'm just saying the rosary, I would definitely go ahead. Absolutely. Anything. If I'm meeting with a person in between sessions to just sit with them and help them get through the week and listen to their, you know, just listen to them, I'll just sit and take my iPad and pray the breviary for that day sometimes. If they want me to pray, I'll just sit next to them and pray the breviary. And I'm not touching them, I'm not talking to the demons, I'm just praying in support to help the person get through the week. And they'll start mumbling and cursing, and they're like, what's he doing? And, you know, and they'll make comments and whatnot. They hate it. Any prayer. Now, I will say they do particularly hate the Psalms. They really hate the Psalms. It just drives them batty. So, like in the pastoral manual that I put together, I think I reference them. You can say any of them, but some of them are very combative. And they specifically ask for God, the Father, to help you when you're beset and attacked. And they hate all that. Yeah. They really hate the litany. I've seen a lot of demons come out just from the litany. The litany alone has delivered multiple demons of the saints. Yeah, the Psalms, the litany of the saints are some of the most powerful things I've seen, the Magnificat outside of the solemn rite.
Severed the right of confession and repentance. They have no more right to him then? Is that how that works?
Yes, but there's, he may not have his life completely squared away yet, which might be why there's still some lingering sense of them.
I'm sorry.
He may not, your friend may not have his life completely squared away yet, just because, you know, I do heroin for 10 years and I almost kill myself and all this bad stuff and the sins that go along with that, and then repent, he may not be completely squared away and living a healthy spiritual life in totality just now. He probably has more growth to do. And so take that as a goad to do more growth and grow closer to God and figure out more about your life that you can repair and make it healthy.
But the fact is that if he would ever revert back to using heroin, the human would come right back into heroin?
Probably, but it depends on whether they love suicide, and of course drugs is a form of self-destruction. Yeah, so, I mean, not every drug addict is demonized, really. I mean, they're demonized in the sense that they're tempted, but are they all possessed? No. But if he's been possessed in the past and he picks up drugs again, then he'll probably relapse. Probably. But it's up to God. But you need to pray for him, and he needs to take that as an encouragement to do more work. Because if it was totally easy, he might get lazy. I think we're good. Thank you so much. Thank you.